Audible Inc. presents A Wild Ghost Chase, written by E.J. Copperman, narrated by James Patrick Cronin. Chapter 1. "This is absolutely non-negotiable," said Allison Kirby. I tried to think of counter-arguments that would move her off that position. "This won't take up much of your time," I reminded her. "It's simply a case of..." "I don't care, Paul," Allison answered. "I'm not interested. There's been enough stress on me and Melissa. No. I don't appreciate being put in this position," Allison scolded me. "And I don't think you should be happy with it either." "It's just a slumber party, Allison," I said. Allison and I have an unusual arrangement. She owns a large Victorian home here in the New Jersey shore town of Harbor Haven, which she has turned into a guest house for tourists who want to come and spend vacations down the shore, which is what New Jerseyans call going to the beach. I haunt it. My name is Paul Harrison, and I am what you would call a ghost. It's a trifle complicated. I was by trade a private investigator. And about 2 years ago, shortly before I was murdered, I took on the case of a woman named Maxie Malone, who owned the house before Allison. Maxie had hired me to investigate and act as bodyguard, since she feared her life might be in danger. It turned out she was right, but we found out too late. Oddly, that was only the beginning of the story. Maxie and I woke up, as we say, a few days later, here in the house. But there was clearly something new and strange about our existence. For one thing, we floated rather than walked. We felt less solid, could move through objects like walls, and were unable to leave the property. It took us a while, but we finally did realize we were dead. As you might imagine, this required a good deal of adjustment on our part. Maxie, 28 years old and somewhat volatile, did not adapt easily to this plane of existence. Being a more mature soul, I was 33, I accepted my fate in only a few months. For close to a year, the real estate agent would give prospective buyers tours of the house, but it wasn't until Allison and her daughter Melissa, who was 9 years old then, came through that Maxie stopped trying to scare off all the prospective buyers and let Allison buy it. Maxie says she allowed it because Melissa seemed like a nice girl. Allison didn't immediately realize that we were here, but soon enough it became clear that she was able to see and hear us, as could her mother, Loretta, and Melissa, a family trait Allison had been previously unaware of, and took some time adjusting to as well. Even now, Allison's ability to see people like me is not as developed as Loretta's or even Melissa's. We estimate she sees only about half of the spirits passing through the house, though Maxie and I are the only ones in residence. Presumably, the area one haunts has something to do with where one dies. "This is not the time for a sleepover," Allison said, defending her decision. "Tony and I are renovating the powder room on the second floor, and you wouldn't believe some of the things we're finding. Did you know there's no floor under the toilet?" Actually, I had known that from various times I'd floated up through the kitchen ceiling, but had never seen a need to mention it. If Allison had called in Tony Mandarisi, her contractor friend and her best friend Jeannie's husband, the damage must have been fairly significant. Allison is very capable with tools and usually handles repairs on her own. "I was aware you were doing some work," I told her. "I didn't realize how much time it was taking." She sighed. "I have 6 guests in the house and 4 of them are last minute," she said. "I wasn't expecting this many people this late in the season, or I wouldn't have started tearing the bathroom apart. I don't have time for anything except the guests and the bathroom. I'm not even driving Liz to school. Her friend Wendy's mom is helping me out, so don't ask me to also have 4 little girls over," Allison went on. "Especially with..." She dropped her voice to a stage whisper. Ghosts in the house. You don't have to whisper. We know we're ghosts, Maxie said, appearing from the ceiling, wearing a very brief pair of shorts and a black T-shirt with the slogan, Just Don't Do It, emblazoned on it. I should have expected you, Allison told her. You're behind this, aren't you? Maxie grinned. I don't know what you're talking about, she said. Allison rolled her eyes and said, as she left the room, Don't ask me for anything for a while. I'm warning you in advance. I'll say no. I gave Maxie a look. Did you think that was going to help? I asked. I couldn't help it. It's so much fun to get her mad. She vanished back into the ceiling, no doubt heading for the attic room she shares with Melissa, now 10. I shook my head. Maxie took some getting used to, and even now I have moments when I fight the impulse to scream at her. She is good-hearted when the chips are down, but when they're not, she's Maxie. There's no time to think about that, however, because just then Melissa came into the game room. She looked, unfortunately, hopeful.
How did it go?
She asked me. My expression must have said enough, because her face dropped before I could answer.
That bad?
I nodded. Pretty bad. Melissa looked distressed.
Mom's not saying so, but I think my dad didn't send the check again, and she took on these extra guests to make some money. But this is the only time I can get all my friends to sleep over before winter break, and they're all going away for the holidays.
Her face was less disappointed than hopeful. Melissa was pondering strategy. I don't know why you didn't ask your mom yourself, I said. You know I'm no good at persuading her, especially when it's not my thing.
Are you kidding? She asked. You talked her into getting a PI license. I figured you could talk her into anything.
It was true, part of a quid pro quo arrangement between Allison and us. A while back, word had gotten around the town about the ghosts haunting her guest house, although we'd never haunted anyone until we were asked to do so, and a man from a tour company that offered travelers unique experiences had approached Allison with a proposition. He would furnish a steady supply of guests, but they would be paying for the opportunity to interact with the spirits of the house on a regular basis. So Allison had asked me, she knew better than to approach Maxie, if we could stage spook shows twice a day to help launch her business. I was more than happy to oblige. Maxie took a little more persuading, but at a price. I told Allison I wanted to keep investigating cases, and I needed her help to do so. One of the things you need to know about the afterlife is that it is not only completely unexplained, it is also eternal and exceedingly dull. Investigation is what I felt I was born to do, but I'd only just gotten my license before my demise. Maxie was my first client, and hadn't had much time to practice. So, in exchange for providing the ghostly entertainment, and keeping Maxie placated, I convinced Allison to sit for a private investigator's license and be my legs on cases that would require someone who could move outside the grounds of the guest house at 123 Seafront Avenue. Well, I couldn't convince your mother this time, I told Melissa. You should wait until she's less busy and then be more direct with her. She respects that.
That doesn't help. She respects me and says no anyway.
Melissa is a very intelligent girl, in some ways remarkably mature for her age, but she is still a 10-year-old and devoted to the things 10-year-olds care about, like slumber parties.
And she's never going to be less busy. She's always busy.
Nonetheless, Melissa turned suddenly and cut me off.
Did you hear that?
She asked. I hadn't heard anything unusual, and said so. Melissa held her finger to her lips.
Shh.
She pointed toward a closet in which I knew Allison kept some cleaning supplies, a vacuum cleaner, spare pool cues and balls, hardly ever needed, since the game room wasn't a popular destination for the senior tourists, and a stack of old magazines that she'd simply never gotten around to recycling. Melissa gestured again toward the door, and I shrugged. Then I, too, heard a sound come from the closet. Something that sounded like a person shifting weight from one leg to the other on what is inevitably, in this house, a creaky floorboard. Or someone taking something off a creaky shelf. I nodded to let Melissa know I'd heard it as well that time, before she could say anything else. Melissa moved slowly toward the closet door, but I held up a hand. If there was danger inside the closet, clearly I was the right man for the job. There is very little anyone can do to me anymore.
"Stand back," I hissed at her,
and Melissa nodded. She stopped in her tracks. I focused on the door, something I've learned to do in order to avoid gaining too much velocity and going all the way through to the outside of the house, and launched myself slowly toward it. I made it through the door easily, but it was dark inside the closed closet. I am used to this by now, however, so I was carrying a small penlight in my pocket. Some time back, Maxie and I had discovered that we spirits could transport solid objects through other solid objects like walls if we concealed the items inside our clothing. No idea how or why it works, but it does. I reached into my pocket now, still hearing some sounds of scuffling in the pitch-black darkness, and turned the light on quickly. But my actions were just a hair too late. I had just enough time to see a bare foot, a small foot, like that of a child, exiting the closet through the back wall, which led toward the hallway and the rest of the house. It moved through the solid wood with no problem whatsoever, although some small object hit the wall and stuck before falling to the floor. The foot, and the small amount of calf I could see preceding it out of the closet, was semi-transparent in the split second I had to notice it. I didn't see any point in following through the closet. Whoever it was had now had enough time to make it anywhere else in the house, or even outside. I puffed out my lips in disgust with myself for being so slow, and then bent down to pick up the small object that had been dropped in its owner's haste. It was a small, unpolished stone in a rough triangle shape, with a hole drilled through its broadest side and a piece of leather looped through it. I frowned.
"Is there someone in there?"
I heard Melissa's voice from outside. I stuck the object and my penlight into my pocket, then floated through the door back into the game room. "There was," I answered her. "But whoever it was is gone now." When Melissa looked puzzled, I pulled the small stone from my pocket and examined it in the light. "The intruder didn't need a door," I explained. "The back wall was enough of an escape route. It was someone like me." That took Melissa by surprise. She opened her eyes wide.
"Maxie?"
she asked. I shook my head. "Someone much smaller. A child, I think."
"There's another ghost here in the house?"
Melissa looked intrigued, but also apprehensive.
"A kid?"
I nodded as I admired the stone. "It would appear," I said. Chapter 2. We agreed that for the time being, it would probably be best not to tell Allison about the possibility of another person like Maxie and me residing in her house. Allison tends to be somewhat squeamish about such things. She's only been seeing us for about a year, and until we knew the whole truth, there was no point in alarming her. Plus, given her current state, which was bordering on frantic, it seemed a bad idea to involve her. But I did concentrate my mind on Maxie, my way of calling for her, and she appeared in less than a minute. I filled her in on recent events, and mentioned that until such time as we could locate the child, I thought we'd best not let Allison know.
"You sure?" Maxie asked with a wicked smile. "I'd be happy to break the news just to see her reaction."
Maxie and Allison have an interesting relationship. Deep down, I think they like and respect the other, but on the surface, their competitive sniping and attempts to get the other's goat are, in my opinion, a little tiring.
"Maxie," Melissa warned, "please don't tell my mom. It's not going to help us, and it will make my life miserable. If there's a ghost here she doesn't know, she'll never let me out of her sight again."
Allison is a fiercely protective mother, so I could see Melissa's point, and I believe Maxie did too. Besides, Maxie might enjoy taunting Allison, but she loved Melissa and wouldn't want to do anything to get her in trouble.
"Fine," Maxie agreed. "But when we do decide to tell her, I want to break the news. Can I? Please, please?"
She looked at me. Melissa gave Maxie an "oh, grow up" look, but didn't say anything, so I answered. "Let's table that until the time comes, okay? We might never have to tell her." Maxie scowled. "Spoil sport." "The first thing we need to do is determine who this child might be," I went on, choosing to ignore Maxie. I didn't get enough of a look to see if it was a boy or a girl, but I'm sure I saw a child, younger than you, Melissa.
"Younger than me and here alone?" Melissa responded. "No mom or dad? That's scary."
"Don't make assumptions," I cautioned her. "Just because I didn't see anyone else doesn't mean there isn't someone here with him or her." I reached into my pocket and pulled out the small stone artifact. "This is all we have to go on." I held it out by the leather strap and let the stone dangle off my hand. Melissa and Maxie leaned in to get a better look.
"A rock?" Melissa asked. "Why would someone carry a rock?"
"That's not what that is," Maxie chortled. "It's an arrowhead, an Indian arrowhead. They're all over the place down here."
"Native American,"
Melissa corrected. I decided against pointing out that many of the same nations inhabited my native Canada as well. It didn't seem the time.
"Whatever. Anyway, if this kid was carrying an arrowhead, it was probably a boy," Maxie suggested. "Girls don't really have much use for those things."
I looked at Melissa, who seemed engrossed by the arrowhead. Clearly, she did not share Maxie's assessment of the situation. Given the identification of the object, I could see some steps to take.
"All right," I said. "Maxie, if you could get online and see if you can make a more specific report on our arrowhead, perhaps we'll see a clear path to finding its owner."
Maxie, who has an affinity for electronics and the ability to use them, not my forte in life, or in death, it turns out, has developed the research arm of Harrison Investigations, which is what I mentally call our collective detection efforts. Not that I've shared the name with Maxie or Allison, both of whom might object, but it was my agency first. She doesn't always relish the work, but she has shown a decided aptitude for it, and enjoys the reputation she has earned. Given her MO, I could expect that Maxie would grumble now, but do a very thorough job and then bask in the attention when she made her report. Sure enough, she sighed audibly.
Fine,
she moaned, drawing the one syllable out to seven.
"What do you want to know?"
"Which nation would have produced it, where it might have been discovered, what it was used for, and what its value might be in the current market. But when you're finished using it as a referent in your work, make sure you give it back to me," I said. Maxie looked at me a moment.
Why?
She asked. Any clue is best kept safe, even if we don't know why it might be important. Maxie looked less than impressed.
Amazing, Holmes,
she said with a mock British accent. Sometimes my associates at Harrison Investigations don't take the process as seriously as I do. Later that afternoon, after Maxie and I participated in the afternoon spook show for Allison's guests, rattling a few overhead lighting fixtures, enough to get them moving, but not so much as to cause them to crash to the floor, and banging drumsticks against the walls of the den while Maxie juggled some fruit we'd found on the kitchen table, the guests who had gathered for the occasion seemed quite pleased and discussed the performance after we had finished, when they assumed we were no longer in the room. The reviews were favorable. Maxie usually retreats to a solitary spot after the spook shows. She is somewhat shy, despite her outward brash appearance, and doesn't relish contact with strangers. But today, she indicated to me that there was something to discuss. Melissa noticed the gesture, too, and the three of us moved into the kitchen, where the guests do not usually roam. Allison doesn't serve food in the guest house. She says it's because she's not a good cook. I don't remember the taste of food very well, so I will defer to her judgment on that. Out of sight from where Allison was answering questions about our activities from the crowd, Maxie reached into a cabinet where she stored Allison's very old laptop computer, which had become Maxie's by default. Allison keeps saying that she's going to get a new computer soon, but hasn't really made any effort to do so. She doesn't always talk about it, but money is usually an issue. My guess is that Allison's doing well enough to pay the bills, but without much extra to spare.
I found out a few things about that Arrowhead, she said as we waited for the ancient computer to boot up. It's a product of the Lenni Lenape tribe, which lived pretty much all over New Jersey and New York. But like tourists today, they used to come down the shore to this area for the summer.
Do you have any idea of the age of the stone? I asked.
Well, the page I saw said that the Lennies didn't last long after the Europeans showed up here. So that means they probably were gone altogether before the end of the 18th century.
Wow, Melissa said. So it's more than 200 years old? Does that mean it's really, really valuable?
Maxie shook her head.
There's tons of these things, she told Melissa. You can't get a lot for them.
Perhaps this one has sentimental value, I suggested. If the person I saw in the closet wants it back badly enough, we can assume an attempt will be made to get it back. Melissa's eyes widened.
You think the kid who had it will come after it?
She asked. That's what I'm counting on. Sure enough, the attempt was made that night, long after Melissa, Allison, and all the guests had gone to their rooms to sleep. Ghosts don't sleep. We're never actually awake, so the effort to sleep would be pointless. We do sometimes become less active, often late at night, because there is little to do at that time. Although I know that some spirits, especially those with anger issues, choose the quietest times in the middle of the night to be the most disruptive, simply out of spite against the living. Personally, I've never seen the point. If that person didn't kill you, what axe have you to grind? Then again, Allison is probably a more understanding host than most. Maxie said she would keep watch on the outside of the house. She is considerably more transportable than I am, and had recently discovered she could move outside the bounds of the property line, something I am not yet able to do. But my guess was that she would set up her position on the roof, where she could watch from all sides at once. Maxie isn't always practical, but she is intelligent. The fact that she hadn't warned me when I heard someone in the library was, therefore, not an indication that Maxie had fallen down on the job,
but that the spirit I'd seen in the closet had never actually left the house. From my position in the basement, I debated whether to follow the sound and confront the stranger, or wait until the child made him or herself known to me. On the one hand, the element of surprise could be an effective tool, but I did not want the spirit, especially if it was indeed a child, to become frustrated and disappointed and give up the search. I chose to follow the sound and remain inconspicuous. I tucked the arrowhead medallion into the pocket of my pants and rose up through the basement ceiling into the hallway on the ground floor. The area was not completely dark. There is a window at the far end of the hallway at the entrance to the game room, and the opposite end leads to the den, a converted dining room with many windows. There was a bright moon, and my night vision has improved considerably since I took on this incarnation, so I could see fairly clearly up and down the hallway, even without pulling out my penlight. No one was there. I stayed as still as I could until another faint sound, like that of shuffling objects, emerged from the game room. Of course, the young ghost had returned to the closet to retrieve the lost object. I rushed to the game room as quickly as possible. I no longer use my legs for locomotion, so much as I do my mind. The will to move propels me much more than a physical effort. I kept my hand in my pocket, resting on the penlight, and barreled through the hallway wall into the back of the closet to block my young prey's exit. As I passed through the wall, I pulled the penlight from my pocket, having already hit the switch to turn it on. Sure enough, the young ghost was there, looking startled and frightened. It was a boy, perhaps 8 years old, with dark black hair long over his forehead and on the sides. I couldn't see him very well in this light, but his eyes were dark and wide. He was wearing a fringed vest that appeared to be something in the family of suede over a plain blue shirt, a beaded band around his forehead, and trousers made of a soft brown material. At first glance, I guessed he was of North American native descent. The boy turned to flee, but I reached out and got a grip on his arm. It takes some effort for people like me to interact physically with objects or people in the living world, but we are easily able to touch those like ourselves. I held on firmly, without creating enough force to hurt him. Yes, we can still feel pain under the right circumstances. "You don't have to run," I said. "I just want to talk." Before the boy could answer, Maxie appeared at the other side of the closet, coming down through the ceiling. She was wearing cowboy boots, black jeans, and a t-shirt whose legend read, "Sometimes cowgirls don't get the blues." "Aha!" she shouted. "You caught him!" The young spirit shook with fright, and I fixed my gaze on Maxie to get her attention. "There's no need to shout," I said quietly. "We just want to talk to our young friend here."
Oh, yeah, sure we do,"
Maxie said. Subtlety is not high in her skill set.
"What's your name, son?"
I asked the boy, trying to lure his astonished stare away from Maxie's shirt and toward my eyes, which I meant to look concerned and kindly. But he would not look at me.
"Who are you?"
"I am Eagle of the Sun,"
he said. As he spoke, his face took on a more composed and defiant attitude, but his voice betrayed his continued tension.
"Let go of my arm."
"Not until I'm sure you won't fly away. But we should get out of this closet," I told him.
I maintained my grip on his forearm and pulled him, gently, into the game room.
"Eagle of the Sun?"
Maggie asked once we were in better light.
"My people would call me Antinanko,"
the boy told her, sounding less frightened.
I changed the words to fit your language.
Are your people the Lenni Lenape? I said.
Lenni Lenape, he corrected. We are the human beings.
I was aware, having seen a film called Little Big Man, that some native tribes referred to themselves that way, so I nodded.
You speak pretty good English, Maxie said, her eyes narrowing.
I have been on this property, or near to it, for more than 200 winters, the boy told her. I have watched many people. I have had a lot of time to learn. Do you want to know who Taylor Swift is?
Before Maxie, who looked a little stunned, could answer, the lights in the game room came on, and we all turned toward the door. If it was a guest, there wouldn't really be a problem, since we wouldn't be visible. But instead, Melissa walked into the room, her eyes on Eagle of the Sun, whose arm I was still holding.
You found him, she said.
You shouldn't be awake, I said.
I try to be an authority figure to Melissa when Allison is not in the room.
This one can see us?
The boy asked. I nodded. You have nothing to fear from Melissa. Melissa, this is Eagle of the Sun. He says he has been here, or near here, for a very long time. The boy stood a little straighter.
I am Antinanko, he said, staring past all of us as if at attention.
Nice to meet you,
Melissa answered. She turned her gaze back to me.
I heard sounds down here. Did you give Antinanko his arrowhead back?
The boy's eyes widened.
You have it? You have my medallion? Give it back.
Just a moment, I told him. If I let go of your arm, will you promise not to leave? I have questions for you.
Give me back my arrowhead, the young native insisted. It's mine, and you stole it.
I'll give it back to you if you answer my questions, I said. That's all you have to do. Antinanko's mouth, clenched in a frustrated pout, opened just wide enough for him to say,
I won't fly away.
I released his arm, and, true to his word, he stayed put.
Now give me back my arrowhead.
As soon as you've answered me. First of all, if you've been here all this time, why haven't we seen you before? Maxie and I have been in this house for more than 2 years. The boy floated up a foot or so, bringing his head to about level with my shoulder, a move I found significant. He wanted to be on equal footing with the adults, but couldn't quite bring himself to a height that would be face to face, and wouldn't go eye to eye with me either. He looked at the wall. His nose twitched.
I'm really good at hiding.
I shook my head. You're not getting your arrowhead if you lie to me, I told him. No one is that good at hiding, not even a 200-year-old native ghost. To his credit, Antinanko chose not to argue that he'd been truthful.
I don't always stay here, he said. My people travel all over this area. I am not bound to the earth, so I move over it.
I looked at Maxie, who had done the research on the Lenni Lenapes, and she nodded. That checked out.
Why are you here now? She asked. Isn't this really the summer area for your people? It's kind of late in the year for you to be down the shore.
Antinanko, now seemingly pleased with the attention he was getting, smiled and stood a little straighter, although his feet were well off the floor.
I do not travel with my people, he said. I go where I please.
That really wasn't an answer to her question, but Maxie did not choose to press him on it. Melissa, however,
had looked concerned at the boy's last comment.
"You travel alone?"
she asked.
"Where are your mom and dad?"
All of a sudden, Antinanko's bravado seemed to fall from him. He stuck out his lower lip and his shoulders slouched.
"I have not seen them since I closed my eyes with the smallpox,"
he said quietly.
"My father was a great hunter and was not in the camp. My mother's face is the last thing I remember seeing. Then I was alone."
"So you haven't seen your mom in 200 years?
Melissa looked shocked. The idea clearly disturbed her.
"I mean, she must be...
"I am sure she has closed her eyes forever, too,"
the young native said.
"But she has not found me, and I have not found her. Perhaps she lived long after me, and forgot that she had a son called Antinanko."
He seemed on the verge of tears, and so did Melissa.
"Mothers don't forget," Maxie told the boy. "She'd never forget. If she hasn't found you, it's because she doesn't know how."
Maxie saw her mother about once a week even now, although Kitty Malone did not see her daughter. But she knew when Maxie was in the room, and the two of them had long conversations on computer screens and yellow legal pads.
"She knew me only 8 winters,
Antinanko responded, but it was clear he didn't believe the implications of what he was saying. Melissa, her eyes moist, looked at me.
"We need to find Antinanko's mother," she said.
The young native, who was looking at the floor, lifted his head quickly to stare at her, although not in the eye. He looked at Melissa's feet.
"You can do that?"
he asked. "Find a native North American woman who'd been dead for centuries? With no historical records, no idea of an accurate time period, no way to get out of this house, and, without involving Allison, which seemed unlikely given her current level of activity, no eyes, ears, and legs on the outside? It was impossible."
"I don't think..." I began. "Paul, you're a private investigator,"
Melissa said, her tone mysteriously approximating her mother's, which she knew made it harder for me to resist.
"You have a client who needs you and an exciting puzzle that no other detective has ever had before. Are you going to float there and tell me you're turning that opportunity down?"
The Kirby women share one trait besides the ability to see ghosts like me. They are single-mindedly determined when they set their minds on something. Trying to dissuade one of them is like trying to talk a hurricane out of disseminating your town.
"You can find missing people?"
Antinanko asked me.
"Sometimes," I said. "I don't see how it can be done in this situation. But yes, that was my job when I was alive." "People give you things to do that? They trade with you?"
I guess that was how he could understand it, although the past 2 centuries of observation must surely have given him some idea of the capitalist system.
"Yes," I said. "They trade with me, and I find things or people." "Find my mother," the boy said. "If you do that, you can keep the arrowhead."
"I don't want the arrowhead for myself," I told him. "But I'm going to keep it until we find your mom." Antinanko still wouldn't look me in the eye, and his fingers fluttered just a bit at his sides. He wasn't happy.
"Why?"
he asked.
"Because I want to be sure you'll keep coming back," I said.
Chapter 3. Despite my continued questioning, the following was all our young client could tell us about his mother. Her name was Moon, which he said would have been Jossie in his language. She was tall and strong, which was not terribly surprising. Antinanko was tall for his age, and probably would have been a large man if he had grown, but had a warm and loving heart. She had been in this area for the summer, roughly 240 years ago. It wasn't, as they say in the detective novels, much to go on. What was unusual, and the unusual is always helpful in an investigation, was that the boy said his mother's hair had not been the dark color of so many native North Americans. Her hair, Antinanko insisted, was red. Once I had, reluctantly, agreed to look into, that was how I put it, the whereabouts of Antinanko's mother, I insisted that Melissa go back up to her room and refused to discuss the matter again until morning. The little native boy said he had a place that he went to at night, one that made him feel safe, and promised at my insistence that he would check in every day for progress reports. I looked at Maxie, suggested she do more research on the Lenni Lenapes, strictly because I couldn't think of anything else to do, and then dropped myself back down through the floor to the basement. I can't feel the heat of the boiler, but I find the glow from its pilot light soothing, and I do some of my best thinking there. This was, at least on its surface, a hopeless case. Antinanko's mother had died more than 200 years earlier, and could have done so anywhere from upstate New York, practically near Toronto where I was brought up, to Maryland. As far as I knew, she had no idea that her son was patrolling the area where he had died of smallpox. Even if she had searched for him, she'd probably given up the effort a century ago, much as Antinanko had stopped hoping he would find his mother until Melissa had helpfully offered our services. I've discovered that each of us who remain on this level of existence after death has some ability, some talent that helps us manage our indefinite time here. Sometimes these abilities seem to evolve. For example, Maxie could now leave 123 Seafront and its surrounding property, although I could not. She was also still better at manipulating physical objects, although I am improving my skills steadily, and can handle pretty much anything I concentrate on touching now. But one thing Maxie has never been able to do that I can is to communicate with the network of spirits like ourselves without speaking or leaving the house. I am gifted with the power of what the living would call mental telepathy, although it's not like an ability to read minds or to predict the future. It is, when I concentrate properly and let myself reach a state of simplicity, a way to send and receive messages from specific spirits or groups of spirits. I can think my way into the attention of those like myself. It's an inexact science, more an art, and Allison, who does not understand it perfectly, refers to it as the Ghosternet, which she believes is amusing. Humor is subjective. If there was a chance I could contact Antinanko's mother, Jossie, I felt I owed it to the boy to try. The process is not dissimilar to meditation. I had made some attempts at the practice in my prior existence, which might have some bearing on my ability to find the proper mental state now, in that it requires an almost passive state. I clear my head of all conscious thought, stop considering current tasks to perform or brooding over the sad state of affairs that led me to this almost alive but not quite existence. I give up any anger, anxiety, concern, or fear I am feeling at the moment and focus my attention. In this instance, I focused on one word, Jossie. I don't really know how long the process takes. I am not wholly conscious of my effort as I make it. What is necessary is for me to be sure I am thinking solely of the one being I'm trying to contact, or, when attempting to communicate with the ghost community as a whole, on the message I'm trying to convey. In this case, I thought of Jossie and Antinanko. I had no mental image of the woman,
so I concentrated on the boy, whose face I had seen clearly. The process has an odd effect. It is relaxing. All that concentration would seem exhausting to a living person, but I find that time passes quickly when I am in this state of communication. So when I next was aware of time, the sun had risen and light was pouring through the basement windows. I don't own a wristwatch, but the angle of the light at this time of the year indicated to me that it was full morning, but not yet time for the 10 o'clock spook show. The creaking of floorboards above me indicated activity upstairs. If the guests were awake, it was a good bet Allison would be as well. I rose up through the basement ceiling, having been unsuccessful in receiving any message from Jossie. It was possible my effort had not achieved a signal strength sufficient to reach her in a faraway area, or it was possible that she had received the thought and ignored it or misunderstood it. What I didn't want to consider was another possibility. Not all those who die return to the world the way Maxie, Antinanko, and I had done. If Jossie had skipped this level of existence, or had already moved on to the next, there was no way I knew of to reach her, and that would mean I'd have to admit defeat to the young native boy. Uncomfortable as the thought made me, I found myself placing a good deal of my hope in the possibility that Maxie had uncovered something helpful in her research. I floated upstairs, passing by the entrance to the library, a medium-sized room with no door that held books for the guests to read while staying here. I don't even know what made me turn my head, but I did. And there, in the center of the library, stood a woman. She was decidedly not one of the guests. She stood tall, shoulders back, hair braided on both sides. And she was dressed as a native would have been in Antinanko's time. Also, she was transparent, one of the people like me. She was a ghost.
Jossie?
I asked quietly. Perhaps my message had been received after all, and this case would be solved with a minimum of difficulty. But I noticed the woman's hair was very dark, almost black, and certainly not red, as Antinanko had suggested. She didn't answer, but stared at me. Perhaps this was someone who knew Jossie, and could tell me of her fate. Even if we couldn't reunite the boy with his mother, he might rest easier if he knew she had moved on to the next level, or had been content at the time of her passing.
"Do you know Jossie?" I asked.
The woman stared for another long moment, then began to speak to me in a language I had to assume was that of the Lenni Lenape, which Maxie had identified as Unami. She gesticulated stiffly, moving her hands as if holding something, and then turning them over, and seemed to think I would understand the significance of the movement. Then she vanished. I stayed there for a while, trying to digest what had just happened. Clearly, I had contacted someone with my efforts, but it had likely not been Antinanko's mother. But if it were someone from his era, why would she not have learned English like the boy had? Were there some tiers of this afterlife that I did not yet understand, where people who had died in one culture were left to it? Why wouldn't Antinanko have been included? It made no sense. Finally, I decided to make my way into the kitchen. I don't like to enter areas where the guests might unexpectedly congregate. It's not that they would see me, but I like to be prepared when there is someone nearby. Since being murdered, I have gotten a little skittish. Perhaps that's understandable. Allison was starting the coffee maker when I first saw her. She makes coffee and tea in the morning for the guests, but does not serve breakfast or any other meal in the guest house. She likes to encourage them to patronize local restaurants. I believe there might be other motives at work, but I haven't pressed the point. I figure there's time to find out. If there's one thing you know for sure when you're a ghost, it's that there will be time for everything.
There you are, she said when she saw me. I was getting worried. Thought I might have to play loud music or something to wake you up. You know I don't sleep, I reminded her. Is Melissa at school already? Allison shook her head. It's only 7:15, Paul. It's not late. It's just that I usually see you first thing when I come downstairs. What have you been up to? This was awkward. Perhaps it was time to mention Antananko's presence and the case to Allison. There's a case I've been trying to... That was as far as I got. Oh no, Paul. If it's an investigation, I don't want to hear about it. Allison sounded very firm. I can't help you now. I'm barely keeping my head above water. And I told you when we started that the guest house would come first. Right now, it has to, okay? You should have let me finish, I covered. I was just saying that there's an experiment that I'm working on. I've been trying to communicate with some people like me. That was technically truthful. And it gave me an idea. Perhaps trying to find any Lenny Lenape spirit might have led me to Jossie or the woman who had just appeared. I would have to attempt that later. Just for fun? Allison asked. Fun? I repeated noncommittally. Have you seen Maxie? Allison gave me an incredulous look. This early in the morning? She asked. Maybe you guys don't sleep, but Maxie isn't willing to talk to anyone before 9. You know that. I wish I could give her some coffee. She finished filling the coffee maker with water and hit the switch that would grind the beans she'd loaded into it. The resulting sound would preclude any conversation for a short time, so I nodded and rose up into the ceiling to search for Maxie, whom I had decided was my best hope. I found her in the attic, where Melissa was brushing out her hair for the school day.
I'm running late, Melissa said. We'll have to keep this quick.
Melissa is a very mature 10-year-old, and sometimes seems to believe she is the chief executive officer of Harrison Investigations. She does have a certain talent for logical thinking that comes in handy on occasion.
Maxie was telling me what she found out overnight.
I turned to Maxie, who was in her morning mode, acting like a sluggish college junior who couldn't believe she'd had to sign up for a first period class. She was lying on her back, in plaid pajama pants and an oversized T-shirt that read, Whatever, and floating very slowly around the large attic room in a circle. Her voice was gravelly, an affectation she used to remind us all how this meeting was an inconvenience for her.
It's not much, she said. I already told you what I know about the Lennies. There's very little anywhere about individuals in the tribe other than chiefs, and they were all men.
She glanced at me with a sneer.
Which figures?
Now it was my fault that a group of natives 200 years ago were somewhat sexist in their attitudes and had an artificial glass ceiling in the tribal hierarchy? Their wives were not mentioned? I asked, trying to steer her back to the topic. Perhaps Jossie was a well-placed woman in the group.
Pah,
Maxie spat out, part amused and part disgusted.
There isn't so much as one woman mentioned by name at all. I couldn't find anything. In fact, when I searched for Jossie, it didn't even come up as a Lenny name. It was Tupi.
I felt my eyes narrow. That's interesting, I told her. Was there any crossover between the tribes? Could a Tupi woman have married a Lenny Lenape man?
Who died and made me Yenta the matchmaker? Maxie asked. I don't know. The internet does have its limitations, you know. Like the fact that a lot of the stuff on it is wrong.
I told them of my encounter with the spirit in the library. I think she was trying to answer me, or to tell me something, I said. But I don't speak Unami. I looked at Maxie. She opened one eye.
You think I speak Unami?
She asked. No, but I'm willing to bet you could find a glossary somewhere, at least a phrase book.
I don't think Rosetta Stone has issued that one yet, Maxie answered. You're going to have to summon up some Indian who speaks English and can translate.
I have my limitations, I reminded her.
So do I.
Why not ask Antonanko?
Melissa asked. He must speak Unami.
Generally speaking, it's considered bad form to ask the client to participate in an investigation. But since this case was anything but orthodox, it was a possibility, however slim.
He probably hasn't spoken Unami in a century, I said, mostly to myself.
Melissa turned away from her mirror and regarded us.
This isn't helping. We promised Eagle of the Sun that we would find his mother, she said.
Actually, I pointed out, you promised him. I tried to make it very clear that this was difficult and unlikely to be successful. Melissa, not always the cheeriest child in the morning, either, flattened out her lower lip and went on as if I had not spoken.
We're not going to let him down. There has to be some way we can track his mother in history.
I doubted it, but anything was worth a try.
If that's the way you feel, Melissa, you have a very good source of information that you can tap.
I do?
Yes. That teacher of yours who used to come by when we first met? He was a history teacher, wasn't he?
Melissa scowled a bit.
Mr. Barnes?
When her teacher had briefly dated Allison, she had reacted the way you might expect a 9-year-old to react to the blending of her two worlds. She became grumpy, stayed in her room when he was in the house, and did her best to discourage the relationship. And, to her point of view, there had been a satisfactory conclusion. Allison and the Barnes man had decided to stop seeing each other because it wasn't a good situation for Melissa. I have to admit to some relief at that development. Allison's choice in men, having met her ex-husband, is questionable at best. I have occasionally thought she would have done well to meet a man like me, only alive. I nodded.
He knew a great deal about this area and its history, I reminded Melissa. We need some expertise in that area.
She was about to respond, no doubt with some very cogent argument against my suggestion, but she had no time. Allison called her from downstairs.
You're going to be late for school,
we heard through the floor. Melissa rolled her eyes.
I've never been late for school in my life, she said.
I nodded. Mostly because your mother or Wendy's mother drives you there every morning. Keep that in mind. And think about talking to your teacher.
He's not my teacher anymore,
Melissa said, then left the room. Children will often conclude an argument by pointing out that the adult involved is incorrect on a minor point. It makes them feel better. It doesn't do much of anything for the adult. I glanced at Maxie, who was pretending to be asleep, but continued to float in a perfect oval around the room at a height of 7 feet.
I really don't think we'll be able to trace one woman in a tribe all those years ago,
I said, more to myself than to Maxie.
Some detective you are, she snorted.
This might have been Maxie's idea of prodding me into action. In truth, it annoyed me, but I understood her intentions. Maxie isn't normally mean, but she isn't always as thoughtful as she might be.
Have you got any ideas? I asked.
She stopped twirling around the room and fixed her gaze on me. Clearly, she'd been waiting for such an opportunity.
Pin the kid down, she said. You're being too nice to him, and he's playing you.
I wanted to protest. No matter how long he'd been a spirit, Antonanko still had the mind and emotions of a small boy, and pressuring him for information would be cruel. He wanted his mother back, and probably had for centuries. Now we'd raised his hopes, and I was all too aware how likely it was that I would be the one to dash them for him yet again. But there was a problem. I believed Maxie was right.
"You think he's been holding back?"
I said.
"He's definitely holding back. He knows way more than he's letting on."
Maxie grinned one of her more conspiratorial grins and lay back into her Cleopatra on the barge pose, an arm dangling off of nothing onto nothing.
"How can you tell?"
I asked, but I already knew the answer.
"You can't play a player,"
she said,
"and I'm a player."
Chapter 4. "Something's going on and you're not telling me," Allison said to me after the crowd from the second spook show of the day had dispersed. Maxie, dripping ectoplasm, really rubber cement, down a wall in the den, had gone over splendidly, and I had flown a bedsheet down the stairs from Allison's bedroom to the kitchen. If any of the guests believed ghosts were violet with a floral pattern, they might have been truly disturbed. Luckily, people like me can't gasp in air, so I made sure not to betray my concern about her suspicions with my voice or expression.
"What are you talking about?"
I asked.
"I'm saying there's something going on in the house,"
Allison repeated.
"Liz barely talked to me before she left for school today, and I think it was because she's afraid she'll blurt something out she's not supposed to say. So tell me what it is. I'll keep your name out of it."
She folded up the sheet I had left on the kitchen table. "By the way, you might have told me you were going into my bedroom for props."
"It was an ad lib."
"So, what's going on that I don't know about?" she continued, undeterred.
"Nothing. You're mistaken."
I rose up toward the ceiling. If this was going to progress, I might want to make a hasty exit. Allison's eyes narrowed.
"I don't think so. You're acting funny, too."
"I'm Canadian," I reminded her. "I don't act funny."
"Martin Short is Canadian."
"Touché."
I heard something clatter in the direction of the game room. Was Antonanko checking back in, as he'd promised? I needed to get inside to find out, but couldn't appear suspicious. Mentally, I tried to summon Maxie, but I was distracted, and it's very difficult to do when I'm not concentrating completely on the task. Worse, Allison's head turned at the sound, too.
"Did you hear something?" she asked.
"What?"
"I don't know. I thought I heard a noise down the hall. Game room, maybe?"
She started toward the kitchen door.
"I'll check,"
I said, swooping past her and, literally, through the door. Allison had no time to argue, but I couldn't be sure she wouldn't follow me. She was right. I was acting suspiciously.
"Don't come. You don't want to know."
That didn't really seem to help much, but I moved on. Antonanko was indeed back in the game room, sitting on, or more accurately hovering over, the pool table that barely anyone ever uses except Melissa and her grandmother, Allison's mother, Loretta. Loretta is a very accomplished pool player, but she often lets Melissa win.
"Was this not the time we had agreed I would return?"
the boy asked as soon as I was in his line of sight. Maxie dropped down out of the ceiling.
"Man, the two of you are lousy at being sneaky," she scolded. "You're being loud enough to wake, you know, me."
I ignored that comment, since no one could hear us, and turned toward our young client. "Now then, Antonanko," I said, although Allison has pointed out that "now then" is contradictory.
"I'm glad to see you back."
It's always best to start by making the subject of an interrogation feel comfortable. They are more likely to divulge useful information that way. But when I looked back at Maxie, I noticed she had changed her clothes, which she does at an alarming rate, into a trench coat, a wool skirt, a pair of uncomfortable-looking pumps, and both a fedora and a green visor. Clearly, she thought she was in a 1940s Edward G. Robinson film, playing the tough cop who would attempt to drag the information out of the even tougher gangster. I was relieved she hadn't chosen to also smoke a cigar.
"Okay, kid, spill it," she began. "What's the real deal on this mother of yours?"
"Maxie," I tried to admonish. Antonanko didn't look either of us in the eye, but it was clear he was addressing me when he asked,
"What does the woman mean?"
"You don't need me to get the bright lights out, do ya?"
Maxie went on. I honestly don't think she knew what she was talking about. I knelt down, which took some adjustment when I first took on this form, since there is nothing on which to lean for a ghost. But it made me appear to be sympathetic to the boy, and brought my face down to his level, even if he wasn't looking at me, perhaps in an effort not to betray unguarded thoughts.
"She means that some of what you told us about your mother does not seem plausible or accurate," I said.
"What do those words mean?"
Antonanko asked in a small voice. I had to make an effort to remember he was only 8 years old.
"It means they don't make sense."
I looked at the game room entrance, where Melissa stood, school backpack still strapped around her shoulders. "And if you don't tell us all the truth, it will make it much harder for us to help you."
"I don't understand," Antonanko answered. "Everything I told you is true."
"You said your mother's name was Jossi, which means moon," I reminded him. "That is not a word in the Unami language."
The boy would not make eye contact. It seemed almost a reflex with him, but even without a direct look at his face, it was obvious that wheels were turning inside that little head.
"My mother was not of our people," he said. "She was taken from another nation because she was a princess and a strong hunter. My father was a very powerful leader of the nation. He could take the woman he wanted."
Melissa looked shocked.
"He could just claim any woman he wanted?" she said. "That's terrible."
"What's terrible?" Allison said. Everyone looked up, with varying expressions of panic, though Maxie mostly looked amused. She grinned at Allison, who was standing in the hallway entrance, her forehead wrinkled in thought.
"What is terrible?" she repeated. "The Lenni Lenape men could take any woman they wanted for their wives,"
Melissa answered, still shaken by that information.
"The girl didn't even get a choice."
Allison smiled with the left side of her mouth.
"Times were different back then, Liz," she said. "How did that happen to come up in conversation? Are you studying them in history now?"
Antonanko was only a few feet in front of Allison, and not obscured by any furniture in the room. But Allison was looking directly through him at Melissa, who had walked to his side.
"Hey,"
Maxie said, but I quickly turned toward her and gave her a disapproving look. That doesn't always work with Maxie, but this time it had the desired effect. She stopped talking. Allison only began seeing and hearing spirits like me after she bought this house and had, let's call it an accident, involving a blow to the head. Her skills are not as developed as Melissa's or Loretta's, who have both been seeing ghosts all their lives. That meant she isn't always able to detect a spirit, even one in the room with her. Apparently, Allison couldn't see Antonanko.
Yeah,
Melissa answered her mother.
"We're studying the Native Americans who lived in this area."
"I thought you did that in Mr. Barnes's class last year." Allison said. Melissa shrugged.
They do stuff more than once. This year's more detail.
Allison put a hand on her hip. Something odd's going on around here. There's been way too much secrecy lately. What are you three plotting? Antonanko looked confused, but Maxie shook her head at him slightly.
We're not plotting anything, Melissa said. You're being... what's the word?
Bananas? Maxie suggested. Paranoid? I said, although, of course, I did not truly think Allison was acting that way at all. She has a certain instinctive talent for understanding things outside her usual existence. In this case, she knew something was going on. She simply couldn't see what was literally in front of her.
"Is this about the sleepover?" Allison asked. "Are you all trying to figure out how to get me to change my mind?"
Melissa looked irritated and started to shake her head, but I beat her to the punch.
"Yes," I told Allison. "We've been discussing it. We thought perhaps there was a way to change the plan so you might feel more comfortable approving."
Allison regarded me for a moment and said, "Sometimes you talk like a corporate PR man, Paul, not a private detective." I smiled in spite of myself.
"So I've been told," I said.
"I'm not changing my mind on this," she said, looking at Melissa. "Not now. Talk to me when we don't have plumbing issues and unexpected guests. Then maybe, okay?"
"Okay."
Melissa pretended to be disappointed.
"Okay," Allison echoed. "I have to go. Tony is putting in a new toilet upstairs, and Mrs. Robeson wants blue towels in her room, not yellow ones."
She stopped just short of rolling her eyes.
"Why?"
Maxie asked. Allison was almost out the door, heading for the linen closet.
"Does it matter?"
she asked as she left. If I were able to perspire, I believe I would have wiped the sweat from my brow after Allison was gone. It was our sheer luck that she hadn't been able to see Antonanko. Allison bristles at the idea of investigating, although I suspect she actually enjoys it deep down, and given her present circumstances, would not have reacted well to another person like me in her house. "Antonanko," I said, returning to our investigation before Maxie could threaten to bring out the rubber hose,
"you have given us a great task to perform, but in order to do so successfully, we need help from you. We need you to give us a direction. You said your father was a very important man in the Lenni Lenape? Maybe we can find out something about him, and that might lead us to your mother. What was your father's name?"
The boy's eyes widened for a brief moment. Then he seemed to recover and blinked twice.
"He was called White Eyes," he said quietly. "He was the first chief to make peace with the white people."
I looked to Maxie, who knew I was asking her to check out that fact, and she immediately left to find Allison's laptop. Once Maxie vanished, Melissa walked closer to the young native boy and dropped her voice to a camp counselor type of soothing cadence.
"Antonanko, do you have anything that belonged to your mother? Something we might be able to trace?"
It was an excellent question. I think Melissa would make a wonderful investigator, though her mother would probably not be pleased to hear that. There are things we keep from Allison for her own good. But Antonanko shook his head.
"I do not have any of my mother's possessions," he said. "The arrowhead you hold is all I carry with me."
He pointed at me, accusing me of holding his precious memento hostage, which technically I was.
"Can I have it back?"
"I will give it back to you when we find your mother," I reminded him. "Until then, I want to be sure I know where you are, and that you'll keep coming back to see us."
I have given my vow, the boy said. I will do as I said I would do.
Good, I answered. So will I. Antananko left soon after that, vanishing out through the far wall toward the beach just as Maxie, concealing the laptop in her trench coat, dropped down from the ceiling.
There was a Lenny chief named White Eyes, she said, but I think the kid is lying about him being his father.
Maxie isn't always as polite as she should be, but her instincts are usually sound, so that concerned me. Why? I asked.
This guy White Eyes died in 1778, she told us.
That is the right time period for Antananko, Melissa pointed out. It's when he said he was alive.
Yeah, but this chief signed something called the Treaty of Fort Pitt the same year he died,
Maxie said, pulling the laptop from her coat and opening it to a web page about the Lenni Lenape.
And that was during the Revolutionary War, right?
Sure, Melissa said, only 2 years after the Declaration of Independence. The war was going on then, and they didn't know who would win.
She was an excellent student, and despite her misgivings about the teacher dating her mother, really liked history class.
So why do you think this points to our client lying to us?
I asked Maxie.
Because the Treaty of Fort Pitt was signed at Fort Pitt, she answered.
My face must have registered my puzzlement, because she added,
where Pittsburgh is now.
Now it was Melissa's turn to look puzzled.
That's in Pennsylvania, she said.
Maxie nodded. If someone other than Melissa had pointed that fact out, she might have made a cutting remark. But she adores Melissa, and respects her youth.
Right, and it's the far western end of Pennsylvania, almost 270 miles from here.
Melissa still looked confused, so I explained. That's a long way for the tribe to have walked, all the way from here to Pittsburgh. I'm willing to bet Maxie has discovered the Lenni Lenapes from this area did not migrate that far.
That's right, Maxie said. The people from this area tended to go south to Delaware. In fact, Unami is another name for Delaware, or up to New York. They didn't go that far west. That kid is still not telling us the truth.
Ghosts can't sit. That is, we don't actually rest on objects. But the habit of sitting, lying down, crouching, all things the living do, is very difficult to break. I've never met a person like me who had completely lost the conventions. So I sat in what must have appeared to Melissa to be midair, and felt my hand stroking my beard. It helps me think. It doesn't make sense, I told them. He wants us to find his mother, and yet he continues to give us false information. What would his motivation be?
Maybe he's confused, Melissa suggested. He is just a little boy, and it was a really long time ago.
I looked at her. He's barely younger than you, I pointed out. Do you think you would forget anything about your mom or dad, no matter how long it had been? She shook her head. So, why is he impeding our investigation? I asked again. Why not tell us the truth? Maxie bit her lower lip.
Maybe he doesn't really want us to find his mom, she said.
My tongue ran over my upper teeth, but there was no moisture. There never is. Then why would he have started this? I said, mostly to myself. It was just as well, because neither Maxie nor Melissa answered me. The Indian woman I'd seen in the library was, I decided, my best bet. The problem was a linguistic one, a communications question more than anything else. There had to be some way to get through to her if I saw her again.
There were questions that normally would be Allison's assignment in a case like this, but I did not reconsider keeping her out of the loop. There had to be another way to attack the problem. I turned toward Melissa. "I think we need reinforcements," I said. She looked at me without comprehension. There are times I forget she's not yet 11 years old. "We need to bring in the big guns," I clarified. Melissa grinned. She pulled her cell phone out of her pocket and pushed a speed dial button.
"Hello, Grandma?"
she said. Chapter 5. Loretta Kirby is an interesting blend. On the one hand, she seems like a very standard older lady, interested in her family, some television, a little local charity work in her active adult community, and her friends. On the other hand, most of her friends are ghosts. She told me once that she's been aware of spirits for as long as she can remember, and she is indeed the best person at interacting with the deceased who I have ever seen. Loretta arrived the next day when Allison was out having a brief lunch with her friend Jeannie at a local cafe, the Stud Muffin, and Melissa was at school.
"So this Eagle of the Sun boy is playing a little fast and loose with the truth?"
Loretta asked after I filled her in on the situation more completely than Melissa had been able to do in their brief telephone conversation.
"Why would he do that?"
she asked as she loaded up Allison's refrigerator with home-cooked food she'd brought over in the backpack she carries. Allison teases her that it makes her look like a student, but Loretta's contention is that the backpack is extremely useful and keeps her hands free. "I have no idea," I told her. "I think our best bet is to contact the spirit of the woman I found in the library yesterday, but I need to be able to speak Unami in order to communicate. At least, I assume so. For all I know, she was speaking Navajo."
"So naturally, you called me in,"
Loretta said, closing the refrigerator with a satisfied smile on her face. Maxie, who was hovering by the ceiling fan and letting the blades rotate through her midsection,
"It sort of tickles,"
grinned. She adores Loretta.
"The first thing a man always thinks of is to get a woman to help," she suggested.
Disregarding the feminist issue she was trying to raise, I turned my attention to Loretta.
"I do think you can help, if you'd like," I told her. "Normally, I would ask Allison to be my legs on this one, but I don't think that would be a good idea at the moment."
Loretta shook her head violently, but smiled.
"No, she's got a lot on her plate right now,"
she agreed.
"Let's not complicate matters. What would you like me to do, Paul?"
I outlined my plan for her benefit, beginning with a visit to the local police station, and admitted it was not terribly detailed. "While you're out there doing what you can do, and if you can make some phone calls, we ghosts are not audible on telephones, I will do my best to locate someone who can speak the necessary language, and I'll also try to find the woman who was here before, since without her, it doesn't matter if I have a translator. Do you think you can help?" Loretta looked determined, as she always does.
"I can try,"
she said.
"Try what?"
Allison appeared in the kitchen door.
"What are you doing here, Mom?"
"I came by to stock you up on real food,"
Loretta informed her. That part was technically true.
"You can't order in every night."
Normally, Loretta would never criticize Allison on virtually any subject, but she does seem somehow insulted that her daughter never cooks. Perhaps Loretta considers it the sign of a failure on her part to teach Allison properly.
"I really can, but I agree I shouldn't," Allison admitted. "But I'm going to be hip-deep in grout for the rest of the afternoon. Thanks for bringing food."
She went to the refrigerator and opened the door.
"Oh boy, brisket."
"Among other things," Loretta pointed out, "you need to feed my granddaughter something other than pizza and Chinese takeout."
I get it, Allison said.
I surrender. So what were you talking about when I came in?
Paul was asking me to ask a friend of mine, someone like him, a question the next time I see him, and I said I would.
That wasn't technically true, but it was plausible, and Allison nodded.
What friend?
His name is Larry, Loretta answered. You don't know him.
Allison looked at me. What do you need to know from Larry? She asked. Before I could stammer and give away the deception, Maxie insinuated herself between Allison and myself.
Aren't you going to give in on this sleepover for Melissa?
She interjected.
The poor girl never gets to have any friends over.
What are you, her agent? Allison asked. I gave Maxie a grateful look for distracting Allison from her previous train of thought.
She'll have a sleepover when I can handle it. And keep in mind, most of the reason I'm not crazy about the idea is because of you.
Me?
Maxie fired back.
What did I do?
Half the time I'm not even sure,
Allison told her.
That's one of the things that keeps me up at night.
Maxie was preparing to perpetuate the argument, less to give me cover than because she was enjoying herself, as I sank through the floorboards into the basement. It was time to try once again to raise someone who could help us with finding Antananko's mother. The process was turning out to be unusually difficult, as I had feared, a case that Harrison Investigations should not have taken on to begin with. But Melissa had made a rash offer, I had been forced to honor it, and now I was stuck in the position of trying to do something I was fairly sure could not be done. I had not gotten all the way into the basement, I believe my hairline was still between floors, when I noticed our client sitting in a corner opposite the furnace, looking at a box of toys Allison had stored from when Melissa was some years younger. He was sifting through the admittedly disorganized carton, discarding dolls and toy jewelry in favor of some of Melissa's more aggressive playthings, chiefly small superhero action toys that were sometimes included in fast food children's meals. He did not seem to notice me as I descended, so I ducked quickly behind the furnace to avoid his attention and watched him. Normally, I would never spy on a client, or anyone else who was not a target of surveillance for an investigation. But in this case, Antananko had been as mysterious as the puzzle he was asking us to solve, so observing him while he was unaware he was being watched had some utility. When people are alone, they exhibit their true character traits. No one is there, or at least no one to whom they are aware, to see them, so they have no need to project a positive image and can do what they please. Antananko was choosing to play with Batman toys. That in itself was not terribly noteworthy. The boy, no matter how many centuries he had been dead, had not aged. He was still an 8-year-old child, and they will play with figures, project personalities onto them, and pretend to have great adventures. Any 8-year-old boy would be happy to play Batman. Any 8-year-old boy from the 20th or 21st centuries, anyway. It was possibly true that Antananko had been existing in the house at 123 Seafront, or somewhere near it, for some time, and he had himself said he was cognizant of current trends in popular culture. So the fact that he was aware of Batman was only slightly odd. Surely he would have had the chance to observe books or television programs featuring the character. So his accurate depiction of Batman, in Antananko's version he was battling with the Joker, represented here by his left hand, whose fingers opened and closed while the character spoke, over some enormous jewel being played by a plastic ring Melissa had owned, did not indicate anything strange on its own. What caught my attention were the toys Antananko was choosing not to play with. Like many children, Melissa had apparently gone through a cowboys and Indians phase. The collection of toys scattered when Antananko had been searching for a worthy plaything indicated she'd had a fairly healthy fascination. There were native headdresses, headbands, and small plastic figures that the boy would certainly recognize as his own people. Aunt and Uncle appeared not to be the least bit interested in them. Again, on the surface, that was not especially odd. But he had evinced such pride in his heritage that his decision to eschew the plastic figures that looked like himself, or people he had once known, was telling. The problem was I couldn't understand what it was telling me. Perhaps now I needed two translators. Aunt and Uncle's game went on for quite a while. At one point, Batman appeared to be menaced by a Tyrannosaurus Rex, whose name appeared to be Mr. Rex, summoned by the Joker, but he managed to subdue it with the help of... I couldn't make out all of what Aunt and Uncle was saying. I did not make any noise, but nevertheless he eventually glanced up in the direction of the boiler and saw me. His eyes rounded and widened, and he appeared to panic. He drew in a sharp breath, or the airless equivalent. "Don't worry, Aunt and Uncle," I said. "It's just me." Apparently that information wasn't soothing enough, however, because Aunt and Uncle vanished. Literally. He was no longer there. When people like me vanish, that's exactly what we do. I called his name a few times, but he did not reappear. And, to be honest, I did not expect that he would. But it was difficult to think of anything else to do. It is times like these that I most envy Maxie for her ability to break free of this property. If I could get out into the world, I might not feel so limited in my abilities. I might not be trying to conduct an investigation with the feeling that I had my eyes blindfolded and my hands tied behind my back. In fact, I might not be so bored and frustrated that conducting investigations for ghosts would ever seem like a good idea. This case had a client who didn't seem to want us to succeed. I was inches from just admitting that failure to our 8-year-old client and telling him he'd best simply move on with the rest of his existence and leave me to mine. Truth be told, the only thing holding me back was the idea that before I told Aunt and Uncle, I would have to say the same thing to Melissa. She is something of an idealist, and disappointing her is the last thing any of us wants to do. Maybe Loretta's promised work would yield some information. Maybe the native woman who had appeared in the library would come back with someone who spoke English. Maybe I could still make some sense of this case, even as it seemed to make less sense to me with each passing minute. I had come down here to exit the conversation between Maxie and Allison, but with a larger purpose in mind. I was going to try to communicate with a broader population of spirits than I had ever attempted to contact before, and hope that in that enormous group, if I could reach them, there would be someone who could help me. As each time I had done this before, I focused on clearing my mind. At other times, I could simply use a meditation technique, like thinking of one word or one feeling, but now I was more agitated than usual, so I relaxed by trying to remember every word and note of Missing by the duo Everything But the Girl, which was a hit in Canada when I was growing up. That helped take my mind off my anxiety, and then I could begin to send the message I had rehearsed. This was a direct request, a plea to any spirits of the Lenni Lenape Nation. If there were some out there, and even I wasn't sure where out there might be, who could provide information about Jossie, or who could translate for me with the woman from the library. I made it clear that their appearance in the house would be extremely helpful. This was not expressed in words exactly, but I made sure that I knew what I wanted, and then wanted it as fervently as I could muster. If I were successful, those of us who can communicate this way might pass the plea along to others. The population of all of us who have died, but remained earthbound, is enormous. When I was cognizant of my surroundings again, I took some time to await any responses that might be coming immediately. There were none. so I made my way to the carton of toys and began to replace the ones Antinanko had been using. I didn't want Melissa, or worse, mice, to get the blame for strewing them about the room if Allison came downstairs. Focusing on the objects in order to manipulate them helped me to concentrate again on the here and now, and not the mental netherworld I had recently been inhabiting. In replacing the items, I considered each toy as an insight into Melissa's psyche. It is an investigator's exercise to strip away all emotion and determine what every object a person displays or owns can reveal about that person. The Batman and Superman figures were more or less generic. They were from fast food meals, but the fact that Melissa had chosen to keep them, particularly when moving from one home to another, clearly meant that they had some significance. They had obviously also attracted Antinanko's eye. The Indian figures, which were smaller and less detailed, like green army soldiers with a solid base so the figures could stand independently, had also clearly been coveted by their original owner. They were in excellent condition, though worn around their sharper edges, showing they'd been played with often. There was no trick in understanding why Eagle of the Sun might find these comforting or significant. Yet he had taken them out of the carton, then decided against playing with them. It wasn't until I considered the small molded plastic dinosaur that something really began to bother me, but I couldn't really put my finger on what it might be. I put the dinosaur into the pocket of my pants and rose up through the unfinished ceiling back into Allison's kitchen. After all this time, I can pretty much pinpoint my entrances and exits and take pride in my precision. No one else seems to notice, but the reward is in the doing. That's what I tell myself, anyway. The kitchen was empty but for Allison when I got there. She was sitting at the center island drinking a cup of tea and looking off into space. I felt like I was intruding and would have gone elsewhere if my movement hadn't caught her eye. She regarded me quizzically. "Where have you been?" she asked. "It's not like you to run from a good fight." She must have meant the argument between herself and Maxie that I had used as a cover to escape to the basement. "I didn't feel like I had anything to contribute," I told her. That was true, if irrelevant. "Well, you missed a corker," Allison said. "I'm pretty sure that at one point Maxie threatened to take off her clothes and appear to the guests by covering herself in chocolate syrup." "You don't think she'd really do that?" I admonished. "I don't doubt for a second that she would," Allison said with a hint of a smile. "But I really don't think she will." "You two have an interesting relationship," I said, but my attention wandered to a native woman, this one younger than the previous one I'd seen in the library, floating into the kitchen from the driveway side of the house. She appeared in traditional dress, a skirt made of an animal's hide, although I could not definitively identify the species, and her hair pulled back severely and held with a clasp that appeared to consist of feathers from an unidentified bird. She peered into the room like a nearsighted person who had forgotten her eyeglasses. I quickly glanced at Allison to check whether she could see our new visitor. I gave it a 50-50 chance she'd notice the woman, who now called out to me in a language I presumed to be Unami. "We don't get along except when we get along," Allison said, responding to my comment about her and Maxie, a good sign that Allison appeared not to have heard the woman call to me. "I suppose not," I said absently. "How long until the next spook show?" I could see the clock perfectly well, but I wanted to set up an exit. "You have an hour and a half," Allison answered, a little puzzlement in her voice. "Why, do you have something special planned?" I tried to look nonchalant as I rose up. "I don't know yet," I said. "Maybe I'll appear covered in chocolate syrup."
The native woman appeared to understand that she was to follow me upstairs, and rose as I rose. Allison did not turn at her movement.
"Let me know. I'll sell special tickets."
Allison grinned, a particularly endearing look on her.
"Start printing them up," I said, for a brief second wondering if...
No, we were just bantering. Sometimes I forget.
"No, really," Allison said. "Are you planning something new?"
"I'm working on something," I lied as I reached the ceiling. "Not sure if it'll be ready."
I ducked up through the ceiling fan and into the next level before Allison could answer. The native woman followed me. I did not speak until we were in Melissa's room in the attic. I'd hoped Maxie would be there, but unfortunately she wasn't. I don't like going into Melissa's room when she's not there and hasn't invited me, but it was where I thought we'd have the most privacy. This was the best place to conduct an interview. The woman continued to speak in Unami, so I shook my head.
"I don't understand," I said. "Do you speak English?"
I took up a position away from the loft bed and near Melissa's pile of stuffed animals, and perched on the radiator. It was probably hot, but I had no idea. Like food and sleep, hot and cold were bodily concerns no more. The woman considered for a moment and nodded.
"Little bit," she said.
I'd hoped for someone who'd become more fluent over hundreds of years, like Antananko, but this was certainly an improvement over our first visitor. So I smiled.
"Good," I said. "Did you hear me call before? Is that why you're here?"
Again, a nod.
"You need help,"
she said slowly.
"Talking Unami."
I encouraged her with a nod of my own.
"What is your name?"
I asked. She dropped her eyes, then looked back up, as if she didn't know whether to be subservient or defiant.
"I am Butterfly,"
she answered. She did not give a Unami name. I nodded.
"Thank you for coming, Butterfly. A boy is here, a boy of the human beings, trying to find his mother, but I speak no Unami. Do you know a woman of the human beings called Jussie?"
Butterfly looked down. I couldn't tell if it was because she was embarrassed to make eye contact, I did not know the customs of the Lenni Lenape, or because she was dejected. But she shook her head.
"No Jussie,"
she said.
"Not our name."
"This would be a Tupi woman,"
I assured her, following Antananko's lead.
"Taken from another nation, the wife of Chief White Eyes?"
This time, Butterfly did make eye contact, and her expression indicated that I must be quite insane.
"Tupi?"
she repeated.
"We have no Tupi with us. White Eyes not with us. He goes west, but we hear of him. Did not take a Tupi woman for his own."
I felt myself frown.
"Did he have a son?"
I asked. Maybe that would be a thread to research.
"One son," she answered, "with white woman."
Now that was interesting. "Did the son die as a boy?"
Butterfly shook her head delicately.
"Young man, go to school, now call it Princeton."
Since Antananko was clearly too young to have attended college, no matter how bright he might be, the idea that he was White Eyes' son was losing credibility by the second.
"How can I find other human beings?" I asked her.
"We stay together, even now. Don't talk much to the white people."
That could explain why she wasn't as culturally assimilated as Antananko.
"Are you in touch with them? Other women?
a woman who lost a young boy to smallpox? She actually sneered at that point.
Every woman in the nation lose children to smallpox, she said. We did not know it was in blankets.
Suddenly it occurred to me to tell her I was Canadian, but my half-British blood was not unsullied with the guilt of what had happened to the natives on the American continent. I nodded. That was very bad, I said. Please, I want to find this boy's mother so they can be together again. Do you know anyone who can help? Butterfly shrugged, which seemed incongruous.
The boy does not give you the truth, she said. Other human beings probably hear you too and not answer because they do not know.
One last thing, I said. I fished the small plastic dinosaur from my pocket and showed it to her. Do you know what this is? She looked at me oddly, then considered the object.
A totem?
She asked. I supposed it was. After a fashion, I said. Can you tell what it represents? Butterfly looked at the dinosaur again, carefully.
Maybe a lizard, she said. But not like one I have ever seen.
That made sense. I put the dinosaur back into my pocket. You have come from very far away, I said. I am grateful for your effort. Thank you for answering my call. You honor me.
It is our way,
Butterfly answered, and then she was gone. These abrupt departures tend to freak even me out a little, but now I was starting to have an idea of what this case was about. Chapter 6. We have to be prepared, I told Maxie and Melissa. When Antanongo comes back again, we have to know what we're going to say, and, I looked directly at Maxie with some emphasis, how we're going to say it.
What did I do?
She asked. You have a tendency to sound like a tough guy in a gangster movie, I pointed out. If you scare the boy, we might lose every chance we have to reunite him with his mother. He could flee and never come back here again.
Oh, like I'm so scary.
Maxie has an interesting self-image, which I believe might be at odds with how the world actually sees her.
Maybe you should let Paul do most of the talking,
Melissa suggested.
He never scares anybody.
She grinned at Maxie.
Not even when he's trying to.
Maxie giggled.
You're right.
She began her rather crude impersonation of me, saying,
Oh, I'm Paul. I'm a ghost. I'm scary.
I assure you, I've never said such a thing, in my life or otherwise. Then we're agreed. I'll talk to Antananko, I reiterated, ignoring her antics. Melissa's phone made a buzzing noise, indicating a text, so she pulled it out of her pocket and read the message.
Grandma says, hang on, it's tough to figure out since she doesn't like to use vowels. Okay, she says she's on her way and will be here in 5 minutes.
Melissa looked up at me, which made me realize I was close to the ceiling. Sometimes I lose my sense of perspective, and when people like me don't pay attention, we can drift in virtually any direction. Excellent, I told Melissa as I brought myself back down to approximately floor level. Allison was downstairs, seeing to her guests and probably setting up one of the meet and greets, which meant Maxie and I would have to submit ourselves to curious tourists asking the same standard questions. I like to help Allison keep her guest house operating, but sometimes the procedures we have to endure are just a little embarrassing. No, I actually can't get in touch with every single one of your deceased relatives. I'm sorry, but even eternity doesn't offer that kind of free time. Once your grandmother makes her report, I think I'll be able to find a way to contact the boy's mother.
How? If you think he's been lying to us?
Melissa asked. I was about to answer when the dumbwaiter to Melissa's room clanked. That meant someone one floor down was attempting to come up. We all tensed just a little. But then the intercom next to Melissa's bed buzzed, and through it came Loretta Kirby's voice.
It's Grandma, Liz, she said. Can you let me up?
Melissa released the lock mechanism on the dumbwaiter, installed at Allison's insistence so no one, living, could enter Melissa's room without her permission, although besides the dumbwaiter, it's also possible to access the attic via pull-down stairs at the foot of Melissa's bed. We heard the dumbwaiter gears start to turn, and in about half a minute, Loretta was in the room with us.
You said 5 minutes, Grandma, Melissa pointed out. That was like 1 minute.
The lights were with me,
Loretta said, waving a hand.
Let me sit down.
The dumbwaiter is easily operated, but does require a little physical effort. Loretta sat on the desk chair, and Melissa sat on a beanbag chair next to her bed. Maxie and I floated about halfway between the ceiling and the floor. We gave Loretta a moment to catch her breath, and then I asked if her research had uncovered anything. She nodded.
I called the Department of the Interior, which used to include the Department of Indian Affairs,
Loretta reported.
They didn't have any records of individual Lenny Lenapes, but they did have their patterns of migration, and I sent that link to Melissa.
I took a look, Grandma, Melissa answered. The group from around here was definitely not with Chief White Eyes.
That's what I told you, Maxie
said, a little irritation in her voice, as if someone had insulted her.
I gave you an Unami glossary, too. Did you see that?
She asked Melissa in a gentler tone.
I looked, and it was a little helpful, but if someone starts talking in conversation, we won't be able to keep up,
Melissa answered. What about the other part of your assignment? I asked Loretta.
Lieutenant McAlone didn't understand why she was talking to me, she responded. She said it's usually Allison who comes asking strange questions and disrupting her work day.
I'll bet, Maxie snorted. I like how she complains. She should have bothered to investigate our murders.
Maxie could be captain of the Olympic grudge-holding team. Not fair, Maxie, I said. You know very well that the lieutenant didn't come to work in Harbor Haven until 6 months after the case had been closed. Lieutenant Anita McAloney had been to the house a few times, so I had seen her. I know she and Allison have conferred a few times since Allison got her PI license, but I don't know the lieutenant well. I assumed she was a good cop and saw no reason not to give her the benefit of the doubt.
What did Lieutenant McAloney say?
Melissa asked. She is very good at keeping adults on topic. Loretta had been anticipating the question. She pulled a small notepad from her backpack and referred to some notes.
There were 4 incidents in the past 10 years that fit your conditions,
she told me.
None of them involved a woman with the right initials, and none of the victims had a nickname.
That was odd. Perhaps 10 years had been too small a sample. Do you think we need to go back farther? I asked Loretta. Her eyes showed some trepidation.
You want me to go back there and ask her again?
She breathed. Not necessarily. I turned toward Maxie. When do you think Antananko will be back? She bristled.
Since when am I the appointments secretary around here? The kid shows up when he wants to show up.
Her t-shirt changed into another that read, And your little dog, too. All our heads turned simultaneously as we heard a creak. The stairs were being pulled down.
Who's that?
Loretta hissed. A good question. Antananko, of course, would not have needed stairs to enter the room. Had we told him to meet us here? I tried to remember. We all watched breathlessly, two of us literally so, as the stairs descended and we heard footsteps on them.
What have we got up here that I can hit someone with?
Maxie asked. Melissa furrowed her brow and gave Maxie a look that indicated she'd prefer not to answer. But she didn't speak.
What's going on here?
To everyone's relief, Allison's head appeared in the opening, and she rose into the attic.
This is about the fourth conference I've broken up in the past few...
When did you get back?
Melissa asked her mother.
I thought you were out.
I was. Now I'm in.
Mom, what are you doing up here?
Loretta, showing a capacity for lying I had not witnessed in her before, said,
I came up to talk to Melissa about getting concert tickets for a band we both like.
It wasn't much, but it certainly was a distraction from the real topic.
Really?
Allison's tone suggested she was not buying into the story. And so the four of you are starting a fan club? Which band? Loretta chewed her lower lip.
Which band?
Yeah, which band do you and Melissa both follow? She pivoted quickly to address Melissa and pointed a finger.
Don't you answer. The question is for Grandma.
This threatened to go on for a while, but it wasn't the problem with which I was most concerned. I was more concerned that as the two women discussed the musical act, Antananko had risen through the floor, not 2 feet from Allison, and took up a position next to me near the window.
Who's that?
Antananko asked, gesturing toward Loretta, whom he had never met. Loretta smiled at the boy, then checked to see if Allison was looking her way. She was. Very quietly, I said to the boy,
Just wait a moment. Let them finish their talk.
What?
Allison asked, turning to face me.
What'd you say, Paul?
This wasn't going well.
Have you found my mother?
Antananko asked. Apparently, waiting a moment meant something different to him. Something on the order of, jump in any time.
Nothing special, I answered Allison. I knew she couldn't see or hear our young guest, but if she were to stay up here and slow down the progress he was expecting, he might leave. I wanted things to resolve themselves now.
Uh-huh,
Allison answered.
Are you aware there are 4 Native American ghosts in the house right now? The one who speaks English was asking for you. Have you been on the ghoster net again?
If Allison could see 4 respondents to my query, that actually meant that there might be as many as 12 or 13 in the house.
I was doing a little communicating, I answered. Sorry for the inconvenience.
4? Antananko said. Is my mother here?
I don't think so, Maxie said.
What does that mean? Allison asked her. Paul's not sorry?
She seemed genuinely confused.
Of course Paul is sorry, Melissa told her. Maxie meant something else.
Allison's eyes narrowed the way a mother's do when her child is being less than honest.
Oh, yeah? She asked. Something about that band you and Grandma want to buy tickets to see?
One Direction,
Loretta said, staring at a screen on the laptop Maxie was holding out for her to see.
That's the band.
Melissa made a displeased face, but I don't think Allison noticed.
Can I have my arrowhead back?
Antananko interjected. 8-year-olds. No matter how many centuries they have been conscious, or how many times they have heard a promise, are not known for their patience. I did not answer him, and this time neither did Maxie, but everyone looked in his direction,
and Allison did notice that. She stopped, pursed her lips, and breathed in. Her voice was quieter than before.
"There's someone else here, isn't there?" she asked.
Allison is an unusually intelligent woman.
"There is," I admitted, deciding to come clean. "We have a client named Antananko, or Eagle of the Sun. He is a Lenny Lenape boy, and we have been searching for his mother."
"You said I could tell her,"
Maxie shouted. Allison's eyes narrowed, and Melissa's widened. Neither of those was a good sign.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
Allison asked me.
"You said you were busy with the guests and the bathroom,"
Melissa said before I could answer.
"We figured you wouldn't want to get involved."
Allison laughed, which was very nearly the last reaction I had expected.
"He's a little boy trying to find his mother," she said, shaking her head. "If I'd known, I would have helped. Did you think replacing some tile was more important to me?"
"You had specifically told me not to bother you with an investigation," I reminded her.
"Yeah, but, well, I thought that meant you wouldn't take one on. I mean, I know I said that..."
"We heard you were having money problems,"
Maxie said, with her usual level of tact and compassion. Allison looked at Maxie, then at Melissa. She put her hand on Melissa's head and caressed her daughter's hair a little.
"We're doing fine. You didn't have to worry about me."
Maxie rolled her eyes, but everyone was silent. I looked away. It occurred to me that I should have understood she'd want to know about Antananko. Until Antananko repeated again,
"Do you have any news of my mother?"
He sounded more insistent this time. We all must have turned our attention to him again, because Allison asked,
"What's going on?"
Loretta informed her of our client's question.
"Could one of the women downstairs be your friend's mother?"
Allison asked. Antananko glanced up, a hopeful expression on his face. I shook my head.
"No,"
I said, perhaps a bit more bluntly than I intended. The boy looked crestfallen, and Melissa's eyebrows rose. Maxie looked at me and said, "That was harsh."
"Maybe so, and I'd apologize later. Now we had to act before the women downstairs left the house."
"Maxie," I said, "please go downstairs." Maxie turned her back on me.
"No,"
she said, mimicking my earlier blunt tone. There wasn't time to argue the point. I turned toward Allison.
"Would you go downstairs and tell the women, if there are no guests around, where we are?"
I asked. "Especially the one who speaks English." Allison nodded, efficient operative that she is, and headed back down the pull-down stairs.
"I don't understand," Antananko said. "How can you know my mother is not one of the women downstairs?"
Loretta, appearing sorry about what she knew was to come, looked at me and nodded. Yes, it was time to be honest with the boy. I still didn't understand everything that had happened, but there was at least one thing I was certain about.
"Your mother is not a Lenny Lenape woman," I said as gently as I could. "And I'm sure you know that. You haven't been telling us the truth this whole time."
Antananko did not look me in the eye, even as I challenged him directly.
"Yes, I have,"
he said, but his tone had no conviction to it. I floated down toward him, but he made a concerted effort to focus elsewhere, in this case beneath his feet, which were about a foot off the floor.
"No," I said, "you haven't. You're not a native boy. You're not a Lenny Lenape. And you certainly have not been here for more than 200 years.
Antananko trembled with what appeared to be suppressed rage, not distress. He bit his lower lip and his fingers fluttered, seemingly without his control.
"Yes, I have!"
he shouted, and Melissa shuddered.
"Kid?"
Maxie attempted, looking less angry and more sympathetic now.
"You don't actually speak Unami. You told us about a branch of the Lennies who were all the way on the other side of Pennsylvania."
"Chief White Eyes wasn't on the Jersey Shore. He was in Pittsburgh, and he never had a son who died at the age of 8. All those things are facts."
The boy looked like he might flee, so I gently put my hand on his shoulder and held his shirt. I'm not sure that could have kept him from vanishing, but I could certainly see to it that he not fly away just yet.
"We want to help you, son," I said, knowing his name was probably not Antananko.
"But we can't, if you don't tell us the truth."
"I am telling the truth. I am Eagle of the Sun. I have wandered this land for over 200 winters looking for my..."
Two native women, people like Maxie and me, rose up through the floor. One was the woman I'd seen in the library, who couldn't speak English, but seemed to have a message for me. The other I had not seen before. I heard the dumbwaiter start to lower itself. No doubt Allison would pull herself back up.
"Do you want these ladies to tell you about the human beings?"
I asked our young client. The woman who spoke what I assumed was Unami began to talk, and the other quickly translated her words.
"We are a moving people," she said. "We do not own land. We use it and we respect it, but land owns itself. You asked about a woman named Jossie, the wife of White Eyes. Jossie is not an Unami name, and White Eyes was a chief from far away."
Antananko appeared to be crying, but it was a frustrated expression on his face, not a sad one.
"It's not true," he said. "None of it is true."
"Do you know anyone named Jossie?"
I asked through the interpreter.
"No one named Jossie was with the Unami," our interpreter reported. "You have been given information that is not correct."
"Thank you both," I said to the interpreter. "I think he needed to hear it from you." I indicated Antananko. The two women ascended into the ceiling, kept going, and were gone.
"It's not true,"
the boy continued to repeat.
"It's just not true."
Allison arrived in the dumbwaiter and walked to her mother, who filled her in on what was happening.
"It's okay, Antananko,"
I said, hoping the sound of the name he'd chosen would calm our client.
"Nobody is angry with you. We still want to help you find your real mother, and I think we can."
Antananko did not look up, but his sobs subsided.
"You can help find my mother?"
he said.
"Really?"
"I'm not sure we'll succeed, but I am sure we can try," I replied. I had hoped that some information we'd gotten from the local police might have helped, but so far, it has not turned up a suitable incident.
"A suitable incident?"
Allison cut in.
"The local..."
She turned toward Melissa and demanded,
"Did you go to Lieutenant McAloney?"
"No,"
Melissa assured her.
"I didn't."
Allison's jaw relaxed, then clenched again when Melissa continued,
"Grandma did."
"Can you tell us when you really became like this?"
I asked our client.
"I am one of the human beings," Antananko insisted. "I died of smallpox many centuries ago."
"No," I told him, "your story doesn't add up. You are the only one of the Lenni Lenape who seem to have absorbed the changes in time. They said the human beings stay to themselves and do not mingle with others. They knew about their time only.
The ladies did not know about technology or the advance of white people in the land.
I have been alone, the boy said. I watched television.
You knew about dinosaurs, I told him, and produced the plastic toy from my pocket. I saw you play with this one, and I heard you call it a T-Rex out loud. But the people of the time you say you are from wouldn't have had a clue what a dinosaur was, let alone the name for a T-Rex. I also saw you playing with Batman. You are a contemporary boy, pretending to be from another time.
Why do you say I lie?
The boy still would not make eye contact.
Because I want to help you, I said quietly.
At that, he vanished, though his shirt remained. Chapter 7. We were at an impasse. From his cultural knowledge, I had deduced that Antananko had died fairly recently, within the past few decades at the earliest. But he had continued to insist he was a son of the chief White Eyes and that he had inhabited this land for centuries. And now he had left, possibly never to return. I couldn't go on without better information, and for reasons I could not begin to comprehend, our client would not provide it. This went on for some time. Melissa briefed Allison on our progress, if you could call it that, so far in the case. Allison sat on the floor next to her daughter's bed and listened, only to blanch at the mention of Ned Barnes or Lieutenant McAloney's names. At one point, she managed to murmur to Melissa, "You didn't call your father, did you?" and looked sincerely relieved when both her daughter and mother confirmed that there had been no contact with the ex, whom she sometimes referred to as the swine. As I mentioned earlier, Allison's taste in men can be questionable. I really don't see another area of investigation, I announced after some consideration. We've done everything we can do, given that the boy, whoever he is, simply didn't give us the facts.
Why not? Allison asked. Why would he start the whole process if he knew he wasn't going to tell you the truth?
It was a very good question. I honestly don't know, I told her. Allison took on a very interesting smile, one that indicated she thought she was clever.
Use your own methods, she said to me. That's what you always tell me. Don't jump to conclusions, just observe. What did you observe?
I thought I had been dispassionately observing, but perhaps Allison was right. I considered what Antananko had told us, but also how it was told. He is a young boy, about 8 years old. He does not look a questioner in the eye. He lectures on subjects when he's not addressed directly. When he thinks he is unobserved, he carries on imaginative games with larger-than-life characters, not unlike most children his age, but more elaborate and perhaps more emotional. He becomes enraged when confronted with facts that do not support his story. If he is contradicted, he will not change his story to make it seem more plausible and blame the questioner for not understanding. I looked up at the gathered group. Did I leave anything out?
He really wants his arrowhead back, Melissa added.
He cries if you tell him no,
Loretta said.
Even though he's kind of a pain, he's also sort of sweet,
Maxie said, then turned away so no one could see her expression.
I'm no expert, Allison said, but it sounds to me like he's got some kind of developmental disability, maybe.
Melissa nodded.
There's a boy like that in school, she said. He has a para who goes with him to every class.
She stopped and shook her head a little.
I don't know why I didn't think of that.
A para?
Loretta asked.
Paraprofessional, Allison told her. They're professional aides who help some of the kids get through the school day.
Loretta nodded. Sometimes context makes all the difference, I said. I turned toward Allison. You are becoming a very good detective. Me? I'm not sure if she was pleased or merely surprised. I floated closer to Loretta. Can you go back and ask Lieutenant McAloney about one more thing? I asked her. Loretta didn't look excited at the prospect, but she nodded. Allison's eyes narrowed. What were you talking to McAloney about? She asked her mother.
Paul figured this boy wasn't really 200 years old, that he had died a lot more recently,
Loretta said.
So he asked me to talk to the lieutenant about records of boys in the area about that age who might have died fairly recently, especially if their mothers were named J.C. or had the initials J.C.
He could have died of natural causes, Allison pointed out, looking at me. Which would mean there'd be no police records. Yes, but I didn't have access to hospital records, I said. The first step is to check the sources you do have. It was something to eliminate, at least. Allison nodded thoughtfully. So you don't find anyone who fits the description? No mothers with the right initials? She walked to Loretta and looked over her shoulder to read the notes from the conversation with Lieutenant McAloney. How many 8-year-old boys died in ways the police would notice over the past few years? Do I want to know? Well, keep in mind that the police file a report any time someone dies alone, even if natural causes are indicated, I reminded her. But there still were not many, were there, Loretta? Loretta was busy scanning the notes, but she shook her head.
Just a few, thank goodness, she said. But I don't see any that fit all the facts, assuming any of the facts are correct.
Allison stopped her as she was about to flip a page. What about this one, Mom? She asked. Loretta stopped, read over the page, and pursed her lips.
I don't see it, Allison. The mother's name was... Oh, I see where you're going. Maybe.
Maxie swooped down from her perch near the ceiling.
Maybe? Maybe what?
Assuming that everything Antonanko told you was maybe a little bit true, Allison said. Maybe he thinks it's true, and that's why he gets so upset. So something close to Jossie would be good, wouldn't it, Paul? She tried very hard not to grin, and failed. You look like the cat that swallowed the canary, I told her. What have you got? A woman and her son, he was 9 years old, were in a car accident on Route 35 5 years ago, Allison said. A big SUV with a drunk driver hit them broadside. The boy was killed instantly, but the mother lived another 6 days in a coma. Her name was J.C.? I asked. Jacqueline, Allison answered, and she might have been called...
Jackie, I heard myself say.
You're so smart,
Loretta told her daughter. I reached over. Give me that page of notes, I said. I need to go to the basement for a little while. Chapter 8.
I think it was because of the helicopter, Jackie Ransom was saying. That's why I wasn't in the same place as Jeremy when I realized I was... like this.
Not knowing whom I was seeking, it had not taken long to send a telepathic message to Jackie. She had answered me almost immediately, in fact, and was now hovering, never still, in Allison's kitchen, where the Kirby women were eating the brisket Loretta had brought with her earlier for dinner. I'm sure it must have smelled delicious. Jackie was a pleasant-looking woman of about 40, with red hair. She had arrived only a few minutes earlier, anxious to see if the boy we knew as Antananko was her son Jeremy, whom she had not seen since moments before the awful, tragic accident that claimed both their lives 5 years before. "It's possible that the difference in time and space kept you apart," I said. "There's no rule book for our existence. Nothing seems to happen with any consistency or reason."
"You're just ticked off because, unlike all these other folks, you can't leave the house,"
Maxie said, her face and upper body visible through the wall. She must not have been paying attention to her placement. I couldn't even read the slogan on her inevitable T-shirt. I ignored her comment.
"When is Jeremy supposed to arrive?" Jackie asked.
In my defense, I had been very clear in telling her that I was not sure the boy who was our client would come back to 123 Seafront. And I was equally honest in saying that he might not be her son. But Jackie was a mother, and in my experience, mothers sometimes act on emotion rather than fact. Melissa, who is a very intuitive girl, which I believe is one of the reasons she is so skilled at communicating with people like Maxie and me, sensed my apprehension at Jackie's question and deflected it with one of her own after she finished chewing.
"How did you convince him to come back?"
she asked me. "I'm not sure I did," I emphasized, picking up Melissa's feed. "I sent out the message to him, but I can't be sure it was received. I told him that if he came back, I would give him his arrowhead." Jackie nodded in recognition.
"Jeremy would want that,"
she said in an attempt to convince someone, perhaps herself, that the boy we knew was her son.
"His most recent special interest were the Lenni Lenape Indians,"
she chuckled.
"Most people say Native Americans, but Jeremy told me they still call themselves Indians."
"Special interest?" Allison asked. She was not as delicate as her daughter about the chewing, but she had a general good nature that gets her through such moments amiably.
"People with Asperger's syndrome, like Jeremy, tend to concentrate on a special interest," Jackie explained. "It doesn't always stay the same, and Jeremy had just started talking about the Lenni Lenapes for maybe a week or two before the accident."
She stared off for a moment, regret in her eyes. Her description of her son left me with little doubt that we had found Antananko's mother. How he would react, however, especially now that I knew he had a disorder linked to autism, was less certain. If he appeared at all.
"Would that account for why there were some discrepancies in his story?" I asked.
Jackie nodded.
"If he'd had more time to absorb facts, he never would have given you a name outside the Unami language."
"Maybe he was trying to make it easier to find you," Maxie suggested. "In his own way, he figured he could give us a hint."
"Does he really think he's Antananko?"
Melissa asked Jackie. She shook her head.
"He's just pretending. But with Asperger's kids, pretending is much more intense."
She seemed to catch herself.
"Everything is more intense."
Allison and Melissa were trying to convince Loretta she shouldn't help clean up when Antananko appeared, rising through the floor. It made me wonder if he'd been in the house all along, or at least for a while, playing with Melissa's discarded toys again before entering. He materialized looking at his feet, as was his habit. But he wasn't all the way into the room before he began to speak.
"May I have my arrowhead?"
Everyone else in the room froze in their motions. Allison started water in the sink, unaware of the boy, then noticed everyone else staring and turned it off. Melissa at the dishwasher loading a plate, Loretta at the refrigerator putting away leftover brisket. Maxie, now entirely in the room, arms extended by her sides as if she were about to lean back and float. And Jackie? I've never seen a spirit absolutely immobile. Usually, if we don't concentrate very hard, we will drift, as if in a light breeze. But Jackie was not moving at all. 2 feet off the floor, partly obscured by one of the kitchen chairs, which was occupying the same space as her left leg.
"Jeremy?" she whispered.
The boy we knew as Antananko looked up with a start. He stared directly into Jackie's face, something I had never seen him do before with anyone. And then he did something else we had never seen before. He smiled.
"Mom,"
he said, and in a split second he flew, literally, into her arms. Jackie held her son very close, and if we could cry real tears, I am certain we would have seen them on her cheek. I know, because there were tears on the cheeks of all 3 living people in the room. I even half expected them on my own.
"I missed you," Jeremy told his mother. "Where did you go?"
Jackie smiled and gulped as if for air, although that was not possible.
"I spent 5 years looking for you," she told her son. "And now these nice people have found you for me."
"What nice people?"
he asked.
"Jeremy,"
Jackie scolded.
"Mr. Harrison and Ms. Malone and their friends here. They found you for me."
The boy's eyebrows knit as if he were puzzled.
"No, they didn't,"
he told Jackie.
"I found them. They found you."
Jackie laughed.
"Of course, honey. How could I have gotten that wrong?" "I guess you were confused."
"I was worried about you,"
his mother told him. Then her eyelids drooped a little, and her smile dimmed.
"And I'm sorry, Jeremy. Really, really sorry."
Jeremy's expression registered confusion.
"For what?"
Jackie sniffled a little.
"For the accident. For the car. I was driving the car. I'm so sorry for what I did to you, baby."
She held her son even closer, and he looked slightly irritated.
"Mom,"
he said, but she didn't let go.
"Actually," Loretta broke in, "you weren't at fault, Jackie. I read the police report. The other driver was drunk and ran through a red light. You tried to swerve away from Jeremy's side of the car, but it happened too fast. You did everything you could."
Jackie didn't have a chance to respond, although she looked gratefully at Loretta. Jeremy spoke before she could.
"You see, Mom, it wasn't your fault, and I'm okay."
Allison, roused by the sound of Loretta's voice, put down the glass in her hand and turned toward Jackie and her son.
"You're together again," she said. "That's what counts."
Then she looked at me.
"They are together again, aren't they?"
I smiled at her and nodded. After that, I heard Melissa quietly relaying the conversation to her mother.
"Yes, that is the important part," Jackie agreed.
She let Jeremy out of her arms, but held his hands.
"And I have a surprise for you. I can take you to Grandpa."
The boy's face lit up.
"Really?"
Allison's face clouded over a bit. While Loretta can and does communicate with her deceased husband, Allison's father, Allison has only seen him once herself, and even that was fleeting. Melissa, who has told me her grandfather does not communicate with her either, saw her mother's reaction and looked sad for a moment. Jackie nodded.
"He would have come here with me, but he isn't able to travel around the way we can."
Maxie gave me a smug look, but I took it as reassurance that I'm not the only spirit stranded in one place.
"He's not very far from here, but it will take us a while to get there."
"You're leaving?"
Melissa asked. Jeremy looked at his mother, who nodded. I saw Jackie mouth the words, "thank you," to him, and then indicate with her eyes that he should speak to me.
"Thank you," Jeremy said, without turning his head at all.
"You are quite welcome," I said. "I'm glad we could help." I considered saying that they should mention Harrison investigations to those of us they meet, but I felt that Allison might object to what she calls advertising on the Ghosternet. I held out a hand for Jeremy to shake. He looked at it, but did not offer his own. Jackie looked at me with an apology, and I nodded, understanding. Quite often, I recalled, people with autism do not care to be touched.
"Can I have my arrowhead?"
he asked instead. I smiled and handed it to him, and he nodded.
"Thank you,"
he mumbled, remembering what he considered an odd ritual imposed upon him. Melissa approached Jeremy timidly, which was unusual for her. She reached into her pocket while saying,
"Take this with you, Antananko."
She pulled the Batman action figure from her jeans pocket and held it out to him. Jeremy's eyes widened, and he actually looked up into Melissa's face.
"Really?"
he asked, then looked at Jackie for permission. She nodded.
"Really?" Melissa said. "I want you to remember us."
Jeremy appeared to be finished with his Antananko persona. He reached over and took the plastic figure, and as he did, the native costume he was wearing became a pair of jeans, sneakers, a Spider-Man t-shirt, and a New York Yankees baseball cap. He smiled, took off the cap, and put the figure inside before putting it back on his head.
"Thank you,"
he said without prompting.
"No,"
Melissa corrected.
"Anis cheek,"
she grinned.
"I saw it in the online Lenny Lenape glossary."
"Anis cheek," Jeremy answered.
"Anis cheek a lot."
After a few more goodbyes, Jackie and Jeremy rose up through the ceiling, holding hands, and were gone. There was a long pause while we all absorbed what had happened, and then the cleanup resumed.
"That's as much nice stuff as I can stand," Maxie proclaimed. "If anybody needs me, I'll be somewhere else."
She vanished through the outside wall, just to prove once again that she could do it.
"Figures," Allison snorted. "Why should she help clean up?"
"She didn't eat anything,"
Melissa pointed out.
"You always stick up for her,"
Allison protested.
"You never give her a break,"
Melissa countered.
"Knock it off, both of you,"
Loretta said.
"I'm going to take off, and I don't want to leave when you're fighting."
She wiped her hands on a dish towel and picked up her backpack.
"So make up, right now."
Her eyes were still a little misty.
"We're not fighting, Grandma,"
Melissa said, walking over to give Loretta a hug.
"We're just bantering."
She had learned the word from her friend Wendy the week before. Loretta kissed her on the forehead, leaving a lipstick mark Melissa immediately started to rub off.
"Well, banter nicely," she said. "I'm out of here."
She gave Allison a kiss on the cheek and headed for the front door. Just to show I could, I picked some silverware off the table and put it in the dishwasher.
"You don't have to do that, Paul," Allison said. "I was kidding about Maxie."
"I know, but it's polite to help."
"You don't have to be polite. We already love you,"
Allison said.
"Scram, if you want to."
I didn't react because I knew it was a casual remark, but that touched me. Maybe I was a little emotionally open just at the moment. I nodded and started descending slowly into the basement. I was about to say, "I love you too," but Allison had turned her attention to her daughter and her kitchen. As I lowered myself through the floor, I heard Allison say to Melissa,
"You know, now that the bathroom work is done, maybe that sleepover wouldn't be such an awful thing."
This has been an Audible Inc. production of A Wild Ghost Chase, written by E.J. Copperman, narrated by James Patrick Cronin, producer Mike Charzik, copyright 2012 by Jeffrey Cohen, production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc.